All right, we are going to get started. Good morning. My name is Hope Hogan, and I'm the administrative law judge designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings upon the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as the hearing officer for today's hearing. Let the record show that it is May 22nd, 2020 at approximately 9:13 a.m. This is the time, date, and place scheduled by the notice of hearing issued by the North Dakota Public Service Commission on March 4th, 2020, and the amended notice issued on May 7th, 2020 for case number PU-19-310. This hearing is being held electronically today via the Public Service Commission website and telephone. The public is encouraged to view the hearing electronically through the Public Service Commission's website at psc.nd.gov/public/meetings/live.php or listen electronically at 1-888-585-9008 with a room code of 259-316-322. I would ask any participants in today's hearing to mute their phones and cameras when they're not actively participating in the hearing. The hearing today is on an application of Northern State Power Company filed on August 30th, 2019 for an advanced determination of prudence to acquire, operate, and own the 98.9 megawatt repowered Maurer County Wind Energy Facility located in Grand Meadow, Maurer County, Minnesota. The Maurer County Wind Facility consists of 43 2.3 megawatt turbine generators. The notice of hearing and amended notice of hearing specifies the following issues to be considered and determined at this hearing. Number one, whether Northern State Power Company's proposed resource addition is prudent, and whether the commission should grant Northern State Power Company an advanced determination of prudence. We will now have the parties make their appearances. Mr. Simpson, can you please state your appearance for the record and introduce anybody that's appearing with you today?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Zeb Simpson with Dorsey & Whitney on behalf of applicant Northern States Power Company. With me today is Mr. Matt Harris of Xcel Energy Services, Inc., also on behalf of Northern States Power Company.
And how many witnesses do you intend to call today, Mr. Simpson?
Your Honor, we plan to call Ms. Bria Shea and Mr. P.J. Martin, so two witnesses.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Johnson, can you please state your name and appearance for the record and introduce any commission staff that's participating in today's hearing? Do we have Brian?
Brian Johnson.
Mm-hmm. That would be Brian Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, are you there?
Sorry, I forgot to unmute myself.
That's okay.
Advocacy Council, PSC, one witness today, analyst Victor Shook, also of the PSC.
And Mr. Johnson, because we may have the public listening in with our hearing today, and they might not be familiar with this process, can you explain what your role is as Advocacy Council?
Yes. Advocacy Council, I guess, simply is to look at a case and make sure that it's in the public interest and that it's good for the ratepayers.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Hsu, did you want to state your appearance for the record and explain your role in today's hearing?
Yes, Judge. Thank you. John Hsu, on behalf of advisory staff, I advise the commission on this case. Along with me, I think the analyst that has been provided for this case is Jerry Lean. And at the request of the commission, we do have other analysts available if you would like to call them as well. However, we do not have a case to present. I think we have Pat Fawn available as well as Adam Renfant at the moment.
And Mr. Hsu, will you or Mr. Lien be questioning any of the witnesses today?
Yes, Your Honor. I plan on having a couple questions for the witnesses.
All right. Thank you. For this hearing, the commission is receiving public testimony in two ways. Number one, you can provide written testimony. Beginning today until June 1st, 2020, the commission will accept written testimony, which can be submitted either by email to ndpsc@nd.gov or by mail to the PSC at 600 East Boulevard Avenue, Department 408, Bismarck, North Dakota, 505-0480. If you represent a group or entity, the commission would ask that you identify that on your written comments. And if you're representing yourself, please include your address with your comments. The commission is also receiving public testimony today by telephone. If you wish to provide telephonic testimony, please let us know by calling 701-328-4081 and leave your name and a phone number to reach you at. And when we come to the portion of the hearing for public testimony, we will call you back to receive that testimony. If you have any photographs or documents to submit with your testimony, if you could email those ahead of your telephonic testimony, that would be great. I encourage the public to take the opportunity to tell the commissioners anything you think they should know about this matter, either in writing or through telephonic testimony. I assure you that what you have to say is important to the commission and will be considered by the commission. We will now move to opening comments from the commissioners. Commissioner Crotchis, would you like to make any opening comments?
I just want to say welcome, everyone. Thank you for participating in the hearing today. Again, we are doing these remotely for the foreseeable future, but I do look forward to a time when we can get back in to an in-person meeting, but that simply isn't possible at this point in time. So thank you, everyone, for your patience, and I think we may from time to time have a few technical challenges, but we will work through them if they should occur. But again, thank you. I look forward to hearing from the witnesses, the company, as well as advocates.
Thank you. Commissioner Christman, did you have any opening comments?
Yes, thanks, Your Honor. I just want to emphasize to people who might be monitoring this outside of the participants that just because there's a settlement reached between advocacy staff and the company doesn't mean that it's been reached by the commission. So there's still time to bring new information to us or to explain why this is a good or a bad settlement. And that would go for, you know, the average ratepayer, someone with some kind of special considerations, shareholders, really anybody. It's a public hearing. Even though the settlement was reached with the advocacy staff and the company, like I said, we still are having the public hearing because we want to hear from you if you have information that you think could be useful to us. And we value your opinions, and that's why we're having the hearing. That's all. That concludes my comments, Your Honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk, do you have any opening comments?
Thank you, Judge. I don't have any opening comments this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for the hearing.
I am in receipt of 14 pre-filed exhibits. Is it correct that the parties have stipulated to the admission of these exhibits? Mr. Simpson?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that correct, Mr. Johnson?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. I would note that on August 30th, 2019, Northern State Power filed an application for trade secret protection for cost, benefit, and modeling information and terms of the proposed purchase and sales agreement filed by Northern State Power in support of their application. On December 18, 2019, the commission issued an order on protection of information granting Northern State Power's request. So pursuant to that order, I believe it's exhibits 2, 4, 6, 8, 11, and 14 will not be available to the public. All the other exhibits have been entered into the commission's docket for this case and are available online through the commission's website and the docket page for this hearing. I will admit exhibits 1 through 14 into the record for this case. Are there any other preliminary matters or motions we need to discuss, Mr. Simpson?
None for us, Your Honor.
Mr. Johnson?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu, did you have anything?
Nothing, Your Honor.
All right. Then I'll turn to you, Mr. Simpson. You can either make your opening remarks or call your first witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. We expect Ms. Shea to have her opening remarks, so the company calls Ms. Bria Shea to the stand.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Shea. Can you hear me? I think you're still on mute, though. Still can't hear you. Try now.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. I didn't realize I needed to unmute it in both spots.
Before you testify this morning, Ms. Shea, I am required by law to advise you on the maximum penalty for perjury in the state of North Dakota. Perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Do you understand what perjury is?
I do.
And being advised on the potential penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
I do.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Ms. Shea. My apologies for not being video linked in. Just a few preliminary questions. Are you the same Ms. Bria Shea that filed pre-filed direct testimony in this proceeding?
I am.
And would you have testified differently today? Are there any changes to your pre-file direct and rebuttal testimony?
No.
Okay. Ms. Shea, I understand you have an opening statement.
I do.
Please read it into the record.
Sure. Good morning, Commissioners Crosses, Chrisman, and Fedorchek, and ALJ Hogan. My name is Bria Shea, and I am the Director of Regulatory and Strategic Analysis for Northern States Power Company, the applicant in this case. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of the settlement agreement reached between the company and advocacy staff for an advanced determination of prudence for the company's purchase of the repowered Maurer County Wind Facility. The company is always looking for opportunities to lower the cost of energy for our customers. When NextEra approached us to offer the repowered project for purchase, we analyzed the opportunity and determined that buying Maurer as a repowered wind project would lower our customers' costs. Therefore, we entered into a purchase agreement for the project, and we are now seeking approval for moving forward from the North Dakota Public Service Commission. All the analysis on the record in this proceeding indicate that there will be both short-term and long-term cost savings by purchasing Maurer. Our analysis on this record indicates that this could be approximately $44 million over the 25 years of life of the project, with much of the savings front-loaded. Staff's analysis using different comparison points still indicates likely savings in moving forward with this purchase as well. Because both the company and staff determined that our purchase of the repowered Maurer County Wind Facility will result in cost savings, we entered into a settlement agreement that is before you today. The settlement agreement is structured similarly to settlements that the Commission has approved in the past. It contains certain conditions that will protect our customers if the company's management of the transaction results in higher transaction costs than expected. It also ensures that our North Dakota customers will receive the full benefit of the production tax credits that are available due to the repowering. You'll note that the settlement agreement also recognizes that the current COVID-19 pandemic could impact timing of the project and the related production tax credit benefits. We believe that the chances of this occurring are slim, and NextEra has let us know they aren't expecting the pandemic to impact their ability to repower the Maurer County facility this year. Further, we understand there is a reasonable likelihood that the Treasury Department will make appropriate changes to mitigate any impacts of the pandemic on PTC qualification. That said, staff is appropriately ensured that any impacts of the pandemic on project construction must be reviewed and approved by the Commission before customers could be impacted. Ultimately, the record before you indicates that the company's purchase of the repowered Maurer County Wind Facility will lower overall energy costs for our customers and is therefore prudent. I look forward to answering any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shea. The witness is available for cross.
Mr. Johnson, did you have any questions?
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu, do you have any questions?
Yes, Your Honor. Ms. Shea, and I'm not sure if you would be the best person to speak to this, but I think to provide some context to this proceeding, it'd be good to know in which proceeding that NSP was actually received approval to have cost recovery of the Maurer project.
In what proceeding did we get approval to recover the current PPA in the FCR?
That's, well, just the of the PPA. Was it only FCR? So
it
was
is,
it only
it
a,
is in
the, sorry, go ahead.
We are recovering it through the fuel clause.
Right, but this is the first direct proceeding that the commission will be evaluating in, and the or have we only evaluated previously through our rider review?
I cannot answer that. I'm not sure if the commission has had the Maurer PPA before them before or not.
Your Honor, this is a Mr. Simpson. The commission has reviewed the Maurer project in the PU 12813 rate case as well when they did a full review of all projects that were currently in the FCR.
Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Simpson.
Okay, that's the only question I had.
Mr. Lean, did you have any questions?
Me? Can you hear me?
Yep, I can.
Okay. No questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Crotchis, do you have any questions?
I just have one or two questions. I think most of mine will tie back to Mr. Martin's testimony, but the one thing in your testimony, Ms. Shea, that you touch on would be the company's goal to be reduce its carbon footprint, be carbon free by 2050. And I think you allude to this in your testimony, but can you just clarify, is this being driven by Minnesota renewable energy mandates, or is it being driven by the company's philosophy to reduce its carbon footprint?
Sure, Commissioner. This is being driven by savings for our customer, as well as our corporate strategy to eliminate carbon and be carbon free by 2050. This is not necessary to meet any Minnesota renewable mandates.
Would it be true that the company's stated goals of reducing carbon emissions far exceed at this point in time any legislation that is in place through the Minnesota Commission? And the reason I ask this, when these projects come are put forth, I think they're some of the rhetoric is that this is really chasing after legislation from another state. And given the fact that on your website, carbon free by 2050, I believe it states, and a number of other very public statements, if you will, in writing, that doesn't seem to be the case, because is it correct that right now the only obligation you are under in Minnesota is to be 30% renewable?
Commissioner, that's correct. Our corporate goals exceed our state mandates, and this project is not necessary to meet any other state mandates. We are exceeding our requirements in any state. So this is not necessary to meet any legislative requirements.
Okay, and just to help me out, have you gone to ratepayers and surveyed them? They're a captive audience. I think you would agree they don't have anywhere else that they're going to be able to purchase electricity from at this point in time if they are within your service territory. So I would define them certainly as a captive audience. Have you reached out to the customer base to see if they are also in agreement with the direction the company is going, or do they just essentially have to go along with whatever the philosophy might be?
Sure, Commissioner. I can't speak to any specific surveys that we've done with respect to customers with respect to our corporate strategy to reduce carbon. I would say it is a common theme that we hear in feedback. I can't say that that's necessarily formal, though, that that customers are supportive of this. I would say that right now with the pricing of renewables, I would say most customers are interested in saving money. So we've got the luxury right now that renewables are in line with our corporate strategy. And so I think cost savings are in the interest of customers, and they would be interested in that. And I also think our corporate strategy is we're a leader in this industry, and we were one of the first to announce our aggressive 2050 goal. And now several other utilities have followed, and investors find this appealing too. So I think it's good for the customers and that it achieves cost savings right now, and it's also good for our investors.
Because this is what seems to be an overarching theme, can you describe, just generally speaking, the challenges in attracting capital for non-renewable generation? Is that a significant challenge for the company right now, for NSP?
Commissioner, I can't speak to that. I'm trying to think of... I can't say I specifically attracting capital for non-renewable generation. I would say that specifically renewable generation is a focus of the investor community and has been, I would say, encouraged and supported. So
more pressure as time has gone on to shift to renewable generation from the investment community? Or is that just too broad of a statement at this point in time?
I think that's a fair statement.
All right, thank you. I don't have any questions. I don't believe for you. I think I will reserve the balance for Mr. Martinson. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Chrisman, do you have any questions?
Yes, Your Honor. What is the value of 100% of PTCs on a repower like this? Most of our PTC discussions have always revolved around new projects, and I'm just wanting to make certain I understand what 100% equals.
Sure, Commissioner. I actually believe advocacy staff, Mr. Shook, addressed that in his testimony. I think he said that the PTC is valued at about $25 per megawatt hour in 2019.
So $25 per megawatt hour, and that'll be for the first 10 years, like a new facility would be?
That's my understanding, correct.
Okay, and then just regarding the possibility of a COVID-related delay, I understand it'll be up to the company to prove that, but explain to me in advance how the company would even do that. How would we know whether it was really because of the COVID delay as opposed to just not paying enough to attract a contractor in a timely manner, waiting too long, those types of things.
Sure, Commissioner. So first, I know we do not anticipate any COVID impacts. NextEra has indicated that the project is on track, and in fact, we're just about to start construction, and it would be in obviously in operation before the end of 2020 to capture that 100% PTC. So we don't expect any impact. However, if there were something to come about, the burden is entirely on the company to come and prove those exact items that you've just mentioned. And so depending upon what they would be, I would expect that that the burden is on us to prove that they are indeed related to COVID and not other delays such as you mentioned.
Okay, and who can tell me just exactly what all gets replaced in a repowering? Is that you or Mr. Martin?
Yes, I could tell you that if you let me open up this testimony here, Commissioner. I think part of it is might be trade secret, so that's why I want to.
Yes, unfortunately, the parts of the project that are most germane to the question are trade secret, unfortunately. I will point the commission to page 4, lines 1 through 13 of Ms. Shea's direct testimony for a description.
And that will be fine. I know I was in there, but working from home, just couldn't find everything right on time, and so I'm sure that will answer it adequately for what I needed to know. I have no other questions.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk, do you have any questions?
I just have a couple, and maybe just one. I'm looking at just in the main application, it's kind of the introductory piece, and it's talking about the resource planning. And so maybe this is some of Mr. Martin, but it's your name on this, Ms. Shea, so I'll just ask you and you can defer to him. But I'm on page 10 of the application, I believe. It's kind of getting into this new wind versus repowering wind, et cetera. And it says here, the base case includes an assumption that the wind energy purchased under existing PPA is replaced after the contract term ends with a generic wind PPA beginning at $38.81, consistent with generic wind cost assumptions in our most recent resource plan. We further clarify that this approach indicates the proposed project does not represent an incremental resource in addition to the 5,200 of unspecified new wind. So just to clarify this, your assumption in the resource plan is that all the existing wind resources, when they expire, are replaced, and then you're doing the 5,200 gigawatts of new wind on top of that?
That is correct, Commissioner.
Okay. And I'm sure that we'll get into this with Mr. Martin, but the modeling was done to show that this project at this price was the best long-term choice versus a new project. So I'll wait to ask him those questions. But you can chime in on that if you have something to offer.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, yes, our analysis was comparing our ownership opportunity versus the existing PPA, and then when that expires, being replaced with generic wind. And so that's the comparison, in addition to a whole host of sensitivities that Mr. Martin can talk about. And we did see cost savings in both the base case compared to our ownership, as well as all the sensitivities conducted.
Okay. I don't have any more questions for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Simpson, did you have any redirect for Ms. Shea?
Just a couple of questions on redirect, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Ms. Shea, is it also true that the record reflects a cost savings analysis, not with respect to replacement wind, but with respect to market energy?
It does, yeah.
And the project shows savings under that analysis as well, correct?
It does.
And so would it be your opinion that notwithstanding any of the company's policies with respect to renewable energy or Minnesota laws, that even looking at a replacement of just market energy without any renewable attributes, this would still provide savings to customers?
Yeah.
And then one other question that was raised with respect to the company's renewable energy and carbon-free goals. You've testified that the company hasn't seen any issues getting financing for non-renewable projects. Has the company seen any beneficial financing outcomes because of its investments in renewables?
Yes, we have.
Can you describe those?
Not in detail, but we've been specifically green bonds, which we've been able to get, and that is specifically related to our renewable energy and carbon goals.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Shea. Nothing further from the company.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Shea? All right. Hearing none, thank you, Ms. Shea. Mr. Simpson, did you want to call your next witness?
Thank you, Your Honor. Xcel Energy calls Mr. Philip Joseph Martin to the stand.
Mr. Martin, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
All right. Before you testify today, I am required by law to advise you on the maximum penalties for perjury in the state of North Dakota. Perjury is a Class C felony punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Do you understand what perjury is?
I do.
And being advised of the potential penalties for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Martin, are you the same Mr. Martin that filed pre-filed direct testimony in this case?
Yes, I am.
All right. Thank you. Nothing further. The witness is available for cross.
Mr. Johnson, did you have any questions for Mr. Martin?
I have no questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu, do you have any questions for Mr. Martin?
Yes, Your Honor. Just a couple brief ones. Mr. Martin, of course, all this modeling is based heavily upon the most recent integrated resource plan. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Hey, Jerry, can I get you to go on mute for a minute?
Yeah, hold on one second.
All right, Mr. Martin. Now, what we're seeing nationwide is a substantial change in demand profile for most all utilities. Is NSP seeing that as well since the coronavirus came about?
Yes, I believe there have definitely been some short-term sales impacts, for sure.
Now, you're saying the short-term, but I know some people are also speculating or believe very strongly that these won't be short-term impacts, and we'll see a notable change in demand profile for most of the utilities for a while to come. Do you agree with that, or do you feel that it's going to be just short-term for NSP?
I think it's uncertain at this point. We've had a lot of discussions with our load forecasting group. So far, they've been really focused on near-term impacts, and certainly there have been some big near-term impacts, especially the commercial and industrial customers with the shutdown, obviously. At this point, our load forecasting group's kind of indicating they think these impacts are going to be primarily short-term. I think a lot of that is dependent on how quickly we see a rebound, whether it's a V-shaped recovery, U-shaped, L-shaped. Obviously, there's some uncertainty there. There's a potential that the impacts could be longer term, but right now we're hoping that they're going to be more short term. We've been discussing the possibility of looking at more scenarios for an upcoming IRP supplement we're going to file, but you know, at this point, the direction from our load forecasting group has been that they think the impacts are going to be short term.
How about more specifically to North Dakota? Have you guys been seeing a notable change in the load forecast for North Dakota?
Unfortunately, I can't speak to specifics. I've just had some high-level discussions with them. I have not drilled down into the state-specific forecast impacts.
Okay. So since your filing today is currently heavily based upon the current integrated resource plan, don't you think it would be beneficial if we waited to get that supplemental filing and maybe a supplemental filing from NSP before we really evaluate this project further?
I think that's a good question. Personally, you know, I think the price level that we're bringing you this project at is competitive, and you know, it's cheap energy that we're going to have on our system for 25 years. You know, even if the load forecast decreases, I think this will still be a competitive resource, and it's still a good generation hedge for customers. As we've shown in the analysis that we performed and some of the information requests that Mr. Shook submitted, where we compared this project to market energy, really every scenario that we've run on this, we've demonstrated customer savings. So I think, you know, even if you look at different sensitivities, I think you'll still see this as a competitive project that makes sense.
Sure. So if we look at these different sensitivities and maybe there's a new sensitivity due to coronavirus, is there any, I guess, what would we need to see in order to find that this wind would not be, or a generic wind resource would not be needed after 2026?
I'm not sure. Could you ask the question again? I'm not sure I really follow exactly what you're asking.
Sure. So is there any instance where we would not need to have any additional generic wind resource or a market purchase of wind after 2026?
I think really at a high level, how our model works is we have a forward curve, a forward price curve, and that's some of the analysis that Mr. Shook had asked for. And we base a lot of our resource investment decisions on that forward price curve. And in this case, we're able to add a resource that is cheaper than our forward price curve. And it makes sense, therefore, for customers to do that. So I think at a high level, that's what we're seeing. You know, some of the generic wind in the IRP, if you recall, we called that no going back wind, where right. We had a number of PPAs expiring. And we're replacing it with generic wind. So really, we ran it two ways. We looked at this contract compared to that generic wind. We looked at this contract versus market energy. And in either case, this contract makes sense and provides customer savings.
Okay. Those are the questions I have. Thank you.
Mr. Lean, did you have any questions?
There. I have no questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Crotchis, do you have any questions?
I do. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Martin. I apologize. I think I may have said Martinson before, so just to correct that. I know who you are. I'm going to, just out of curiosity, but I think it's an important point to be able to ask and to know. You short term, you've seen a decrease in terms of demand. Has that been true for the residential side of the equation as more people have spent additional hours in their home, kids not going to school? It would seem that the residential usage would have increased during the current health situation, and that commercial understandably would decrease. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, that I think that's correct. I haven't been intimately involved in some of the analysis of the most recent load forecast impacts. I've had high-level discussions with our load forecasting group and others, but I have heard that our residential usage is up and the CNI is down. So exactly as you described.
Okay, and that would make sense to me. But overall, it's still an overall decrease, though, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
When you are looking out 5, 10, 15, 20 years forecasting the amount of energy that you will need to serve customers, how do you factor in distributed energy resources, rooftop solar? How is that factored into the modeling?
So we work with our load forecasting group, and they have some subject matter experts in their group who help provide some distributed solar and other distributed generation forecasts. So that is a component that we include in the resource plan. We do have a distributed generation forecast that impacts our need, and we factor that in when making resource decisions of what we need to add for energy and capacity.
Okay. Now, here is probably my biggest question, and that is, I keep going back to the generic wind price estimate of $31.81 a megawatt hour. And yet, you've entered into PPAs, including some in the 1,850 or 52 megawatt portfolio, that were significantly less than that. And I believe the range was in $16 to $19, $17 to $20 per megawatt hour range. Can you help me try and reconcile why the estimate for generic wind is significantly higher when you just were able to demonstrate that you could purchase it for significantly less?
Sure, Commissioner Crosses, that's a really good question. So I think the primary reason for that is because in our generic wind forecast, we're including transmission interconnection costs. I think we've discussed this with you in the past. I know I've had a number of discussions on the stand with all of you about the MISO interconnection queue process. And if you look at their most recent February 2017 queue results, some of the interconnection costs that came out of that, we're seeing numbers as high as $2,000 a kW for some of those projects for interconnection costs. And the majority of those projects dropped out of the interconnection queue. I think only two projects remained after all the developers kind of saw the cost there. So that's a big reason you're seeing the prices forecast in the 30s versus some of the recent wind that we added in the 20s. The most recent wind that we added, that $20 number or thereabouts is just the wind project cost. So there isn't a whole lot of transmission cost included in that $20 figure. If you think back to the MVP lines and the CapEx 2020, all that transmission spend that occurred in 15, 20 years ago, up until just a couple of years ago, I think the last project was completed. That's really the spend that enabled that really cheap wind. So again, and I know Commissioner Fedorchak's mentioned this in the past, is if you were to factor in some of the transmission costs associated with the MVPs and CapEx and add that into that $20 wind, you'd probably be, somewhere in the 30s. So you'd see those numbers better align.
So we're getting to a point in terms of generation in the country, in the MISO footprint in particular, that the cheap wind, as you described it, was possible with largely the existing transmission system, plus CapEx 20, the MVP projects, of which one was given an advanced determination of prudence, I believe in 2016 by the commission, for the Ellendale to, I think it was the Brookings line. Is it gotten to a point where because now I'm looking at the overall company plan to keep adding renewables, but incremental additions of renewable energy, from what I'm hearing, are going to be extremely expensive. Would that be true?
I think potentially yes. If the only wind additions we can add in the future are greenfield wind additions, and then I think that may be the case. However, if we're able to pursue repowers like this opportunity before you hear with Mauer, where we can reuse existing interconnections and avoid massive transmission investment costs, I think that's where we're going to want to focus our efforts. I think there's possibly some other opportunities to with net zero type projects and maybe reusing some other existing interconnection rights, and maybe repowering with wind and locations. But we're really doing everything we can right now to try to figure out ways that we can overcome this MISO queue issue. There may be alternatives to us other than simply building greenfield wind sites that have a extremely high transmission cost. So we're actively exploring those. But this repower project here is one of the ways that I think we can avoid that.
Okay, given the fact, and I agree, greenfield projects will be extremely expensive. With that, I don't see where companies who own facilities, existing facilities that are aging and approaching or at the point of being able to consider repowering. I don't have any type of figure or figures in front of me that would indicate there are so many gigawatts of potential repowering that can be done, other than I would expect it's substantial. That companies simply aren't going to walk away from the facilities they have on the ground, but rather they will repower given the high cost of new interconnection costs. So how do we know? It would seem like there would be ample opportunity to not just look at this facility, but does this make sense versus a repowering scenario that might actually be a better deal for the company in the future? How do we know that this is really as good as it gets and that something better won't come along?
Sure, that's a good question. I think we are working with our developer counterparts who we have PPAs with, and then we're constantly exploring opportunities for repowers. We've brought some other repowers previously. We have been discussing the possibility of doing some sort of repower RFP in the future potentially. So we'll see where that goes. What I can tell you is, right now looking at this project, there are guaranteed customer savings. We would repower this project. We'd own it for like a 5-year period in the beginning where we're displacing that PPA that goes to 2026. And we're significantly reducing customer costs during that time frame. And that's not dependent on a market price forecast or a price forecast for generic wind. We know what the PPA price is. We know what our own price is, and there's substantial savings there. And that's guaranteed. What I can't guarantee you is what other opportunities are out there. Like I said, we're talking to other developers. We're trying to explore those opportunities. But I don't know if some of our other counterparties are going to bring us deals that guarantee us customer savings like this.
Okay, and I know I have one more question. Bear with me for a second, please. You know what? I'll search for it, and so we can keep moving forward. I'll find it, but for now, I'll yield, and that would conclude my questioning at this point in time, Your Honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Chrisman, did you have any questions for Mr. Martin?
Well, most of my questions, Your Honor, for Mr. Martin have already been answered. And maybe this should, the only other one maybe should have been for Ms. Shea. I don't know who it's for, but is North Dakota the last advanced determination that the company is seeking before going ahead with this project, or are there others that you're waiting on yet?
I believe we're still waiting for approval in Minnesota as well.
And South Dakota doesn't do ADPs, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. I have no other questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk, did you have any questions?
I do. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Martin. A lot of my questions relate to the company's integrated resource plan. So not necessarily directly to the cost of this project, but since this project is part of that, and you guys reference a lot of the IRP in here, and it's a good opportunity to talk with you about that. I will dive into that area a bit. So first of all, help me understand how you determine how much low-cost renewables is enough. It seems like there's an unending appetite for low-cost renewables. What's the formula that tells you you've got enough for your demand or projected demand?
Sure. So really, it comes down to when we run our resource planning models, we're focused in our resource plan, we're focused on the 15-year forward period. Really, we're looking at our energy and capacity needs, and we're looking at the combination of resources that's going to allow us to meet those energy and capacity needs at least cost. As we set up the model, we have all our existing resources, many of which are retiring or expiring in the 15-year time horizon. You know, we're looking to retire all of our coal in our resource plan. We have a number of gas units that are retiring as well, and we have some PPA expirations. We look to replace those with a combination of new resource options. We have some demand-side management options. We have renewables, and we have gas. We don't evaluate new coal. We don't evaluate new nuclear. We just don't see those as viable replacement options at this point in time. But given all those new options and given the energy and capacity needs, we run the model, and it selects the best combination of resources to help serve that void of energy and capacity due to expiring resources. So really, as we've told you before, with some of the costs we're seeing with renewables, they are some of the lowest priced options, and our model selects renewables and typically a combination of renewables with gas backup as the lowest cost option. So I think you'll continue to see us look to add renewables in the future as it continues to be economic and it continues to best serve our energy and capacity needs in that least cost manner.
And does your model apply a generic capacity for the wind capacity factor, or how does it deal with that?
Sure, so in terms of a capacity credit, we assume about a 15% or thereabouts capacity credit. So for like 100 megawatts of a nameplate wind, we assume that 15 megawatts of that project can be used to meet our load obligation in MISO, that peak load obligation, firm capacity. In terms of capacity factor, which is energy production on an annual basis, for our generic wind, we're typically assuming around a 45 to 50% capacity factor, and that's consistent with some of the new wind that we've seen coming online here in recent years.
Okay, and that's for your energy calculation?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay. In your modeling, it sounded to me like you were factoring in some of the transmission costs, but tell me how your model does that, factors in the cost of transmission
Sure. So our base forecast that we use for renewable pricing comes from NREL. We use their annual technology baseline. So they provide a forecast for a number of years for the cost of wind, cost of solar, and they have different locations. So we select a location that's consistent with our region of the country. And so then we take that base underlying price and add into it that $500 per kW of transmission cost, which can increase the dollar per megawatt hour levelized price by, you know, $10 to $15. So that is the forecast we then plug into the model. So when the model is going to select wind, it sees wind at a $35 per megawatt hour cost rather than a $20 cost if the 20 just represents the cost of the wind project.
Okay, very good. And the $500 per megawatt hour cost comes from where?
So we've worked with our transmission group quite a bit to try to determine what a good estimate for that is. You know, it's very difficult to project exactly what transmission costs are going to be. We've seen a number of different indicators come out of the MISO-Q studies, as I mentioned earlier. Some of the highest costs we've seen are 2,000 a kW. So frankly, we could potentially do sensitivities up to 2,000 a kW. But just working with our transmission folks and looking at historical data, and along with some studies we've had done for us by a company named Excel Engineering. Sorry about that. We felt that $500 a kW was reasonable given all the kind of data points we had out there. But like I said, it's not an exact science. It's just our best estimate of what we think those costs are going to be.
Okay. Have you done any sensitivities as to the breaking point, where if it's $1,000 per megawatt hour or $1,500 when it isn't the most affordable option, when the renewables kind of tip over and it's not the affordable option anymore?
Sure. We haven't done a specific breaking point analysis, but I can tell you that the $500 a kW is kind of enough to push it to the point where it's very challenged and the model almost doesn't select it economically.
Okay. Let's see here. Tell me about assumptions that your IRP makes on battery use, capabilities, costs, et cetera.
So the question was, what assumptions does our model make on battery storage? Is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
Sure. So in the July IRP filing, for the first time, we had not included a generic battery storage resource before, but we developed a price forecast for a battery storage resource, and we included that as an option, like we give the model options to select renewables, gas, DSM. It also had an option to select a four-hour battery storage resource. And again, we had a price curve that we developed for that, that the model looked at when we ran the model and developed a preferred plan back in July. It did not select any of the battery storage resources. The model essentially views battery storage similar to demand response or similar to a combustion turbine. And the cost of a combustion turbine is cheaper than battery storage given our current outlook. So the model selected combustion turbines to fill our capacity needs rather than battery storage.
Okay, so what saturation point do you feel you can get to on your renewable goals without battery technology?
Sure, I think that's a good question, Commissioner Fedorchuk. If you think about MISO, MISO is essentially a big battery. So we can procure a lot of renewables to serve our own load, but we also have the ability to sell some of our excess renewable production into the market. So that's some of what's happening here. In our models, excuse me, we have a market interaction, a market tie limit where we're able to purchase and sell a little over 2,000 megawatts to and from MISO. So part of the economics of some of these renewables is we are selling some of the excess to the market and realizing some revenues for those market sales. So that kind of allows us to help justify getting to higher and higher levels to a certain extent.
Okay, so basically that suggests significant overbuilding of the renewables.
To a certain extent, I mean, that's something that that we look at closely. We, again, it gets back to we view generation as a hedge for our customers against just simply buying from whatever the market is, whatever the market, and being subjected to whatever the market price is. I think we're to a point where, yes, we are making some market sales with our renewables, but, you know, a decent chunk of it is helping to serve load as well. With the variable nature of renewables, it's impossible to fully shape the renewable output to always serve your load. But that's where MISO comes into play for us. And to your point on battery storage, I think at some point we do see battery storage coming into play in the market. And that's just going to help renewables. It's going to soak up some of that excess. When we're potentially making a lot of market sales, we might have battery storage that can start charging off of that renewable. We're also exploring opportunities for like hydrogen production. We've been looking at that at one of our nuclear sites in particular, where you can build some electrolyzers and you know, essentially produce hydrogen, and that creates additional load that can soak up excess renewables as well. So we're actively exploring ways that we can better shape that renewable production to match our load. But you know, certainly it is a consideration, and we want to be wary of that. We want to make sure that we're not selling too much of this to market and not over hedging customers on an energy basis.
Okay, Mr. Martin, you've talked a lot about MISO, and so I try to spend a fair amount of time working on the MISO issues myself. And they see growing complication for delivering greater than 30% renewables on the system. And when you get to 40%, they see significant complications in terms of increased costs and decreased reliability. What's your company's view of that? When you, I mean, 40%, that's like chump change for you guys. You guys believe that you can get to 80 and 100% on a relatively short time frame. What do you know that MISO doesn't know?
Sure, that's a good question. I wouldn't say that we know something that MISO doesn't know. I think their estimates around the 30 to 40% is I believe that's on a footprint wide basis. So that's all of MISO getting up to that level. I think if you look at our region is obviously a very highly penetrated wind region. We already have a massive amount of wind resources in our footprint area. And we're already at fairly high levels of renewable penetration. I think when you look at some of the goals that we've set forth, such as the 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030 from 2005 levels, we've done a lot of modeling to look at that. We can get there, you know, pretty much by just shutting down our coal units, which emit a lot of carbon, and not adding a massive amount of incremental renewables. I mean, we already have a decent amount of renewables on our system. We do need to add a good chunk of additional solar resources to help us get to 80 by 30, but generally it's just kind of eliminating the coal really helps us achieve that. We think the study work that MISO has done is really valuable, the renewable integration impact assessment work, kind of all of that. We have some of the same concerns about very, very high levels of renewable penetration. And I think that's why with a lot of our stakeholders, we're trying to advocate for natural gas. You know, we think natural gas is going to be an important resource in the future. We think our nuclear units are going to be a very important resource for the future. We want to see some portfolio diversity and are concerned about reliability events, particularly in winter, because we think if electrification continues to grow, we could see demand grow in the winter and see a lot more energy sales in the winter. And that's a concern because solar is not available in the winter. And we've seen periods of renewable droughts where we have extreme winter events and the wind isn't there. So we are aligned with MISO in wanting to dig into that type of analysis and understand reliability impacts and make sure that we're positioned to avoid that as much as possible in the future.
Do you think your company is being honest with customers about that piece that you just talked about? Because typically when I see your guys' news releases, it's we're going 100% renewable and it's going to save customers money. I've also seen copies of presentations that members of your company have made to groups, not like groups of customers, but more industry insiders that talk about significantly high costs of energy at some of your later points, like $2,000 per megawatt hour. So why aren't you guys talking about some of those cost concerns more publicly so that the people you serve understand the trade-off that they're going to be facing down the road?
Sure, that's a good question. I think part of the answer to that is because, you know, I think I've heard our CEO say a number of times, I don't bet against technology. I think we're confident that there are going to be technology improvements, and that was one of the caveats that we attached to the 100 by 50 goal, is it's dependent on new technologies to become available, develop, become more cost-effective that aren't available today. We're kind of actively exploring some of the areas that we think may develop. I mentioned hydrogen production. You know, we may have the potential in the future to burn hydrogen at our gas plants rather than natural gas, which would be a carbon-free solution. We've talked about carbon sequestration and opportunities there. You know, we're actively monitoring battery storage, small modular nuclear reactors. I think we're hopeful that we see some significant cost improvements in some of these areas, and that would really position us to achieve that 100 by 50. But certainly I think we've tried to be transparent in our view of, given today's technology, it's gonna be extremely difficult to go to 100 by 50. We had a consultant named E3 come in and present in some of our IRP stakeholder workshops, and they performed some analysis that showed, you know, what it would take to achieve 100% by 2045, and they showed some astronomical cost numbers based on current technology today and current cost forecast today. So yes, it's a challenge for sure, but we are hopeful that conditions change, technology improves, and we're able to do it cost effectively in the future. And we've said, you know, we will only do it if it is cost effective. So if we can't achieve it cost effectively, I think, you know, that you may see the position change.
I have seen the comments about, you know, this being dependent on technology, but I haven't seen that translated to customers, meaning this is going to be expensive if technology doesn't come along. Usually the comments are, we can do this and it's going to save you money. So, I mean, what's the downside? I mean, who isn't supportive of that? Everybody would be on board for making those changes if you can be more environmentally sound and save money. That is a win-win for everyone. I just, Dave Cedarquist is, I'm sure, tired of my comments along this line that the company is not doing enough to be upfront with customers on the cost of some of your plans. And I continue to feel that way. One more question for you, and that is, I think you sort of got into this with Commissioner Christman, but just to follow up on that a little bit, the interconnection agreements that every company has are pretty valuable today, given it's the queue and the the grid that's pretty full right now, do you see the need for or the desire for incorporating more renewables driving retirements for projects that already have a connection that maybe aren't renewables? So a project that has a high, like say 1,000 megawatt interconnect that isn't renewable, all of a sudden that project won't be cost effective anymore or efficient because a company wants to replace it with a renewables and use that interconnect for some other purpose. You see that happening?
Yes, we do see that happening, and I think the GRE Coal Creek announcement is a good example of that. I think that renewables are definitely playing a role in that. You know, they're zero marginal cost energy resources that are coming onto the system and driving down LMPs, and therefore making it less economic for coal units and other thermal units to operate. I think part of the issue too has been natural gas prices being so cheap. So it's not just renewables. It's also the fact that we've seen natural gas prices drop significantly over the last number of years. I mean, we've seen natural gas prices below $2 an MMBTU, and they've stayed relatively low for the past few years. So the fact that you have extremely low gas prices and it's almost cheaper many times in the year for gas units to operate relative to coal is kind of placing some downward pressure there. So I think coal in particular is seeing the most pressure, but certainly gas resources are not super economic as well in the current environment.
Does Xcel have resources like that you're looking at, where they have a valuable interconnect and you're looking at maybe we should retire this early and replace it with something else, maybe beyond the coal facilities that we've already heard you talk about?
Sure. So we do have a number of gas units that are retiring in our 15-year time horizon for the IRP. I think we are talking about ways that we can potentially replace those. We are talking about renewables, so maybe solar, but I think we're also looking at gas replacement potentially as well, because we have said that we think gas is going to play an important role. Gas, in our opinion, is still cheaper. And it provides, you know, firm resource reliability relative to 4-hour battery storage. So we think that we're probably going to look at potentially repowering some of our existing CT sites with new CTs, but certainly we are looking at renewable replacement as well.
Okay, I think that concludes my questions. Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you. Commissioner Karasius, did you find the information you need for your other question you wanted to ask?
I did. Thank you, Your Honor. It was buried in pages of notes, but I did find it. And it goes back to the cost of, you know, and in part ties to have you surveyed customers, Commissioner Fedorchak, was, you know, along the same lines in terms of people really know what's coming down the road, potentially coming down the road. So with gas generation, you've alluded to that. In order to get to a carbon-free situation, however, that would entail carbon capture as well. Is that true?
Yeah, potentially carbon capture, or, you know, we could burn hydrogen. Hydrogen may be another option at some of our gas burning facilities. So I think we view those as two potential options in the future to help us achieve that goal.
How expensive is it to retrofit an existing gas plant to change fuel source like that?
Based on preliminary numbers I've seen, it's pretty expensive right now to pursue burning hydrogen. And I think that's why you haven't seen a lot of entities out there pursuing it. There is a plant, I believe it is in Utah, that LADWP is looking at converting and burning hydrogen in. But, you know, again, it's a technology we're monitoring. Europe's pretty active in pursuing hydrogen production and use as a fuel. So we're kind of hoping others do the exploratory exercise and hopefully drive down costs and that we can benefit from that later on.
Okay. Why not retrofit your existing coal facilities with carbon capture equipment? It seems like you've got facilities that, and I don't have the dates in front of me, but the Sherco units, I believe the one Sherco unit had an expected life of 2035, or maybe it was 2033, but for an extended period of time. Did you do any modeling in terms of retrofitting those facilities, still getting to your carbon-free goal, but not exposing ratepayers to what might be exorbitant costs in the future?
So I, good question. I think the concern there is a near-term investment in carbon sequestration would be pretty expensive as well. One challenge that we face in Minnesota here that, you know, in Utah, they have some underground caverns that they can use for carbon sequestration and storage. In Minnesota, I don't believe that we have, like, the geologic formations that would enable that. So that is one factor that kind of drives up the carbon sequestration cost in Minnesota and makes it much more expensive. But I think just generally the costs have been a little bit prohibitive on that option for us.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Simpson, do you have any redirect?
Yes, Your Honor, just a few items. Mr. Martin, we actually had a very good and fulsome discussion about the company's resource planning here, and I think we should talk a little bit about how your larger resource plans sort of, actually, I should say how the Mauer project itself sits into your sort of larger resource plans. You know, I just want to make sure that I'm clear. The company's goal is to be carbon free, not 100% renewable by 2050. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And with respect to the gas retirements you were talking about earlier, those gas plants are at the end of their useful lives. That's why you need to retire them and find some other alternative.
Yes, that's correct. And in some of the cases, we've actually extended the lives beyond like the book retirement. So some of those units are over 40 years old and are in need of retirement or replacement.
Okay. And, you know, there was some discussion about, you know, renewables overtaking or pushing out other kinds of resources and things like that. You know, help me understand from your perspective, is this really the markets at work, and help me understand if it's a single driver that you're aware of, or is it really just the march of time or some confluence of events?
Do you mind restating that question? I'm not sure. Sure. I really follow exactly what you're asking there.
Is it your opinion as a resource planner that it's really renewables that are pushing out coal resources, or is it a series of different drivers that all together are pushing that?
I think it's a combination. You know, as I mentioned, I don't think it's just renewables. I think the drop in natural gas prices is really a big driver as well. So, you know, again, you think about as a resource planner, your resource options. You have renewables, gas, a whole host of options, and really not only are renewables becoming more and more cheaper, but gas is becoming more and more cheaper, and that's, you know, really what's driving the market towards a new paradigm.
And so would it be fair to say that these are the markets at work and that this was really an outcome of driving down energy prices for all that MISO's functional purposes?
Yes.
Okay. Now, with respect to your resource, one other thing, just real quick. You know, Commissioner Fedorchak raised this issue of cost versus outcome, and I think that's an important point. I mean, I just want to confirm with you here that just because the company has announced this strategy doesn't mean that it doesn't have to go get approvals for rate making purposes from all of its regulators on a resource by resource basis. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And even if the Minnesota Commission were to approve your resource plan, implementing your resource plan is still subject to additional approvals, and you would bring those projects to all of the states in which you provide electric service. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Now, with that framework in mind and the company's no going back strategy that's talked about a lot, in our filing here, you know, help me understand Mauer's context within the larger resource plan and why we should also be looking at the project, why normal resource planning considerations look different when we're evaluating a repowering project.
Sure, so I think when we're modeling for a resource plan, you know, I talked a little bit before about the generic new resource options that we let the model select from. We have our generic greenfield wind resource, but we don't have any other type of wind resource that the model can select from. So we don't have a brownfield wind that represents a repower opportunity. So I think that's what makes it a little bit hard to understand this is when we run our IRP model, the Mauer repower type option is just not available. So you don't see maybe any wind showing up economically because greenfields are too expensive. However, when we're brought a project like Mauer and we can plug that into the resource plan, you know, it's a cheaper wind resource that the model didn't have access to before. So we can show customer savings because when the model is able to select that project, it selects it and it displaces some other resource that's more expensive. So that's at a high level kind of what's going on in the modeling.
Did staff ask for a different set of analyses? Did advocacy staff ask for a different set of analyses that essentially disregarded your resource plan?
Yes, they did.
And so help me understand that analysis that you performed at staff's request.
Sure. So Mr. Shook had requested that when we do the cost benefit analysis, we look at the own project versus the existing PPA for another 6 years, and then just market energy on the tail end, for the last 19 years. And that's different from our IRP, because in the IRP, we displaced the PPA, but then on the tail end, we looked at displacing generic wind. So I think it was actually helpful that Mr. Shook asked for that analysis, because if we didn't have the wind there, wind replacement there after the PPA expired, the other option would be just buying market energy. And what the market energy analysis showed is that under a high, medium, and low market price forecast scenario, we'd realize savings under all three. So I think that helped provide a more robust picture and help confirm that this is a deal that's worth pursuing.
And would it be fair to say that the analysis staff performed ignores your IRP? And so even if you didn't agree with that way forward, Mauer still makes sense?
Yes, absolutely. Because I think in the absence of adding any new resources, that's our alternative. As a member of MISO, we can simply just buy energy from the market. So yes, I would agree with that characterization.
And, you know, I also see that unlike in past filings and sort of the larger resource planning discussions that we have, the company also submitted what it calls the pro forma analysis. Can you help explain what that is a little bit?
Sure. So the pro forma is just kind of a simplified calculation approach. I think when you get into strategist modeling, a lot of times I see people's eyes gloss over. It's interesting to me, but not necessarily to others, because there's a lot going on in the modeling, right? There's a ton of different resources that are being considered. There's existing resources that are moving around. Dispatch on the system is pretty complicated and difficult to understand. So we thought just providing a more simplified pro forma, which represents in a simplified manner what is happening at a high level in the model. And that is, if we buy this project, we're displacing the PPA for the first 5 or 6 years that PPA would still be in existence. And then after that, in the model at a high level, where we think we're displacing other generic wind. So that's what the pro forma shows in kind of a more simplified fashion that I think that the average person can kind of follow and conceptually understand.
And the pro forma analysis and the strategist analysis were more or less in the same ballpark. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And I think that's where you see that at a simple high level, that kind of is what's happening in strategist if you reduce all the noise. So yes, the savings levels were consistent.
And you also analyzed the Mauer repowering project without market sales. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe we did.
And were market sales a significant contributor to the economics of this particular project?
I don't recall 100%. Do you know where in my testimony exactly that may have been discussed?
Yes, I'd be happy to point you to page 14, lines 3 through 9 of your testimony.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. I see it now. So the level of savings is pretty consistent with the base scenario. So yeah, we are not dependent on market sales to show customer savings for this.
And so, looking at staff's analysis that you performed for them with market sales replacing your generic wind assumption, would you expect sensitivities and sort of the same different looks that you've made to end up in this essentially the same place from a market sales standpoint as well? I mean, from a staff's analysis.
Yes, I do. And I think a lot of what is driving that, again, is that guaranteed savings on the front end, where we displace the higher cost PPA with the lower cost OM project. And the fact that we're accruing the 100% PTC, you know, really helps lower that cost in the front years.
And so the PTCs, I mean, that's a significant set of savings for this project. Is that correct?
Yes.
And under the PPA, you're not really seeing the benefits of the PTCs, but you will now that you own the project. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And with respect to transmission costs and other renewables coming onto the system, if you were to use staff's analysis instead of your generic wind analysis, you know, all of that kind of falls out. Is that fair to say as well?
Yes.
So based on that, and you know, what's your ultimate opinion with respect to this project?
My opinion is, you know, I think it's a good deal for customers. Again, that guaranteed savings on the front end is material and you know, not based on energy price forecast, not based on a renewable price forecast. And then again, just thinking about the levelized cost of this project, you know, I know it's a trade secret. I'd love to be able to say it. I think it's at a level that if you think about having a resource that costs that dollar per megawatt hour levelized cost on the system for 25 years, given what we're seeing in our price forecast for renewables, for market energy right now, I think it's a valuable resource to add. And I think it's a good hedge for customers to have for the next 25 years.
And so ultimately, notwithstanding any of your future looking resource plans, this is just an opportunity that came to you that it's your opinion is worth capturing.
Yes.
Okay. Nothing further.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Simser. Are there any other questions for Mr. Martin?
Your Honor, this is Randy Christman. I do.
All right. Go ahead, Commissioner Christman.
Well, Your Honor, I didn't intend to go down this track until Mr. Simser's questions and reliance on the old, well, it's just the market at work shtick, which I don't know, I think you have to go to North Korea or Venezuela to find a market more convoluted than our energy markets. But anyway, they went down that road. So here we go. Mr. Martin, can you give me an estimate of how much coal generation XL has retired in recent years and has announced plans to retire in the future?
Sure. So the bulk of our coal, so our Sherco units, Sherco 1, 2, and 3, and King are really the large baseload coal resources on our system right now. We have not retired any of those units yet, but the plan is to retire Sherco 2 in the 2023-24 timeframe, Sherco 1 around 2026, Sherco 3 around 2030, and then King would be retired in 2028. So we're looking at a staged retirement over the next 10 years of all of those large coal facilities.
And how many megawatts would that be, just approximately?
So Sherco is around 2,100 megawatts, all three of those units. And then King is 600 megawatts. So it's a pretty substantial amount of capacity.
And how much baseload natural gas have you added to replace that?
At this point, we have not added any combined cycles. And recently, I think you're all aware that we were looking at buying the Mankato facility, and ultimately, you know, everything that transpired there that recently got sold to another counterparty. We are looking at building the Sherco combined cycle, which is an approximately 800 megawatt unit at the Sherco site to reuse some of those interconnection rights that we talked about earlier. But at this point, we don't have any plans for additional combined cycles beyond the Sherco resource.
So replacing about 26 or 2700 with 800, correct?
That's right. And in the resource plan, I just want to note too, we do show a number of CT additions in the 2030 to 2034 timeframe. So we're anticipating that we'll likely be adding some additional natural gas CT resources, not combined cycle, to help replace some of the capacity we're losing from the coal.
When in a recent case, different company, wouldn't necessarily apply to you, but on a peaking plant, When I asked the question of what happens if natural gas prices go way up, my own paraphrasing of the answer was that it would have an impact, but it's not a real major concern, because this isn't a plant that's meant to run that frequently. And so, you know, most of the costs are capital related and connection related, not so much the cost of gas. Do you disagree with that on peaking plants?
I disagree to a certain extent. I mean, I think if you look at our forward energy market price curves, those are driven by natural gas prices. So if gas prices increase significantly, you're going to see that forward market price increase as well. I think one thing to think about in that scenario, you know, these types of wind projects would have a lot more value, because if gas on the margin is really driving up market prices, we'd be able to, you know, sell our renewable output into the market for much higher prices, presumably. So that would make these projects look more attractive, and it would be a more valuable hedge for customers to have, so that they're not having to buy natural gas generation that might be expensive.
Where am I wrong that with these CT plants that don't run that often, the cost of the natural gas itself is not the major factor in the cost of having the plant.
Sure. So I CTs aren't meant to run much, but they're not running much right now because we kind of have a glut of capacity and high energy providing resources in our region. You know, we still have a lot of coal online. As I mentioned, we haven't retired any of our large coal units yet. So we have all that coal, we have a decent amount of gas resources, and then we have a bunch of renewables that are providing a bunch of additional energy, primarily wind, that are coming on the system as well. So I think what you're seeing is just kind of a glut of energy and capacity, which has pushed prices down, along with the fact that natural gas prices are low.
I think that really what I'm seeing is kind of a phony argument that it's natural gas prices that are the driver here. I would believe that in the case of combined cycle plants, if those were being built frequently, but I don't buy it with the peaking plants. Now, the last thing I want to get into is when you talk about the good prices, like what percent of the average retail residential customer is their average bill now compared to what it was 10 years ago? How much has it dropped with all these renewables? Is the average residential bill 95% of 2010 rates, or 90%, or 85%, or what?
Unfortunately, I don't have that information at my fingertips. I mean, I have seen some, you know, public presentations that we've put out where we've kind of talked about the fact that our average residential bill has been pretty flat over the last 5 years, but I can't speak to how it compares to 10 years ago, unfortunately.
Gosh, with all this cheap electricity you're generating, I thought it shouldn't be flat. I thought it should be dropping dramatically. So you're saying it's just dropped a little bit?
So as far as I know, it's been pretty flat. And I think, again, that's driven by some of the cheap renewables. It's driven by the fact that gas prices have come down. So, you know, fuel costs are generally lower.
Well, I think would you disagree with this? Because I think the actual truth is that you just mentioned, again, the cheap renewables and the cheap natural gas. And yet you can talk about that. You can market it to try to persuade people of that truth, but the fact is your rates have gone up. Is that correct?
Again, as far as I know, our rates, our average bill has been pretty flat. You know, I think when you talk about rates, you know, it's a little bit different because average bill is rates plus fuel impact. If you're focused just on rates, that kind of excludes the fuel component. You've probably heard us talk about our steel for fuel strategy, where we're looking at making capital investments in renewables that have zero marginal cost energy, which therefore reduce fuel. So I think there's a bit of an offset there, where when we make the capital investments, you may see an increase in the base rate, but you also see an offsetting drop in the fuel component. So that's what's helping to keep the average residential bill flat. But if you look at it on a rate impact basis, then yes, you may be seeing some increases in the rate. Again, that's offset by the fuel component. But let me caveat, I'm not the rates expert. So, you know, that's my understanding. That's my view of things.
No other questions. Enough said, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Are there other questions for Mr. Martin? All right, hearing none.
Your Honor,
go ahead.
Sorry. Okay, no, forget it, Your Honor. Sorry about that.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. Let's reconvene at 11:05. All right, we are back on the record. Mr. Simpson, do you have any other witnesses or anything further at this time?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Then I will turn to Mr. Johnson. Do you want to call your witness?
I would, Your Honor. I'd call Victor Shook.
All right. Mr. Shook, are you there?
I am.
All right. Before you testify today, I'm required by law to advise you regarding the maximum penalty for perjury in the state of North Dakota. Perjury is a Class C felony punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Do you understand what perjury is?
Yes.
And being advised on the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
Yes, I do.
All right. Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Shook, can you state your name and give you a brief account of your education and experience?
My name is Victor Shook. I'm a public utility analyst for the Public Service Commission, representing advocacy staff here today. I have a bachelor's degree in accounting, and I have approximately 6 years of experience in as a public utility analyst.
And you've reviewed the application, you've filed testimony and also testimony in support of the settlement agreement, is that correct?
Correct.
Is there anything else you'd wish to add this time to your testimony?
No.
Is it still your opinion that the settlement agreement is in the best interest of the ratepayers?
Yes.
Okay, I have nothing further, and I'd present Mr. Shook for questioning.
Thank you. Mr. Simser, did you have any questions for Mr. Shook?
No questions, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Hsu, did you have any questions for Mr. Shook?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Shook, would you maybe go into a little more depth of your evaluation on the project and how your evaluation differed from NSP's?
Sure. I think Ms. Shea and Mr. Martin covered this earlier, but essentially, the company has took the IRP approach and kind of even went further into saying, you know, once we have a certain amount of wind, we're not going back. So they were assuming that when this original PPA that's in place expired, they were going to replace it with whatever the wind available at the time was, be it a PPA or owned wind. And that would be in 2026 when, you know, wind prices are going to be uncertain at that time. So it's a relatively high cost. I don't see that as a good least cost solution for ratepayers. So I took a very simplified approach to this. I mean, you know, essentially our option here is to approve ownership, which has a, you know, kind of what we can lay out as a known cost over the next 25 years. And the alternative is paying for the existing PPA that is already in place and will expire in 2026. And then the only question remains of how do we replace that at the end of that time? And I think the best, most reasonable option for our ratepayers is to compare that to market energy rather than choosing one specific resource. And in those scenarios, the situation came out where customers were better off with the ownership scenario. And I will say that it's not because this is a cheap wind, as has been, that term's been used a few times today. It's because it's the least, it's a lower cost wind than the PPA price. And I won't get into saying what all those numbers are because all that's trade secret protected, but the PPA price is relatively high. This wind price is not a least cost or a low cost, I'm sorry, rephrase that. It's not a low cost wind. It's just lower cost than the PPA. And then by the time the PPA expires, it is lower cost than forecasted market energy.
Sure. You said when the PPA expires, how do we replace that, the required energy? Some of you just stated, Mr. Shook, how much would our jurisdictional share be replacing?
Are you saying megawatts or megawatt hours?
Why don't we go by megawatt hours? Or how about megawatts would be better?
I guess, yeah, megawatts probably simpler. So, I mean, this is not quite, I'm trying to recall if this is trade secret. Let me peek at this real quick. I don't want to.
The size of the facility is not trade secret. The nameplate.
Thank you. So this is a 98.7, I believe it is. So let's just call it for rounding purposes, 100 megawatt facility. North Dakota's share of the NSP system is approximately 6%, so 6 megawatts is what we're talking about.
No, I asked this question to Mr. Martin as well, Victor, but no, we've heard that we're probably going to receive a supplemental filing of their for their IRP in the future, which of course their evaluation is based heavily upon that. And do you feel that it's necessary to wait for that supplemental filing or to receive an update from the current IRP for the commission to make a decision on this?
In my opinion, no.
Okay. Do you think any of the current changes that we've seen regionally or nationally or and locally could change your cost evaluation that you provided the commission?
You know, certainly anything's possible. Everything's a forecast. I don't see it as very likely. I try to evaluate the range of what I think are reasonable futures in this situation. And in my opinion, customers are going to be better off even in the worst case scenario.
The customers would be receiving very little benefit. Isn't that correct?
Yes. The analysis, I think, showed that North Dakota customers would only see about a $3,000 benefit over the 25-year life. But it's still a benefit versus a cost.
Sure. So you don't think that current changes that we've seen around might have a $3,000 difference in your valuation?
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right, those are the questions I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lean, did you have any questions?
You hear me? There we go.
Now I can. Yep.
Okay. No, I have no questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Crotchets, do you have any questions?
Just one, Your Honor. Victor, over the course of time, you've watched generation, a change in generation evolve. Do you believe that, mentioned earlier, but also presented to the commission from MISO in terms of the 30% penetration at that, you know, going forward, that will create significant cost challenges. Would you agree that for lack of a better words, that we're reaching a tipping point, if you will?
I don't know if we're reaching one today, but we're certainly approaching within the coming years, reaching that. I'm not sure that I would refer to it as a tipping point, but certainly a time where the more renewables that come onto the system, the more challenging and probably costly they're going to be.
So increasingly more challenging in terms of what costs going forward might be.
Sorry, can you?
I was just reiterating, becoming increasingly more challenging from a cost standpoint.
Yes.
So with that said, how realistic do you think it is from a cost standpoint what consumers would have to endure if the company continued to move down the path of 100% carbon-free?
I guess I would expect that to be significantly more costly than kind of allowing multiple types of generation instead of just, you know, just wind and solar, for example, probably some hydro in there, but it's probably not a good long-term solution, I guess.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Victor. I don't have any other questions.
Thank you. Commissioner Chrisman, did you have any questions for Mr. Shook?
Yes, Your Honor. The first one, I think, is just to clarify what I think is obvious, but I just want to hear it from you. In your original filing, you had called for three conditions, capping the allowed total purchase price, that shareholders would be responsible for shortfalls in the PTCs and the quarterly construction progress reports. And those are agreed to in this settlement, correct?
Correct.
But then in Ms. Shea's rebuttal testimony, she clarifies that in the capping the costs, that some certain additional costs should be allowable or allowed, including attorney's fees, engineering and technical services, project management costs, support services such as environmental land rights and regulatory costs, and contingency costs. Now, yes. In the settlement, are those allowed?
Yes, they are.
And you're agreeable to that?
I am. So the number, and again, I'm not going to say the number unless you absolutely need it. The number agreed to in the settlement, it's actually not in the settlement, it's in the joint stipulation that was filed in this case, does not match the dollar amount that was in my testimony as the total dollar amount. And the reason for that is those costs were not part of my original, the number that was in my testimony. But the analysis that was conducted that determined, you know, what the cost is of the ownership scenario did consider those additional costs. So the total number that we're agreeing to in the settlement agreement and the joint stipulation was the actual number considered when we compared the different scenarios for which what is best for customers.
And you agreed that it would be prudent for the ratepayers to pay those additional costs as well?
Correct.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk, did you have any questions?
I do. It's more of a clarification. Good morning, Victor. When you evaluated these costs, can you clarify, did you evaluate what would be the impact if you let the PPA expire and then purchase not on the market, but, you know, do a different wind that is quote unquote low cost or cheap wind? Or is there no way to evaluate what that would be? Is that just this market price that you guys have kind of agreed to?
We didn't necessarily agree to the market price. I take that approach just because that's the most reasonable. Not, you know, there's no what the future is going to hold. There's no knowing for certain what it's going to be, but I think that's the most reasonable view of the future. You know, NSP's original proposal had us doing what you were saying, you know, replacing it with wind at that time. And we don't know what the future of wind is going to be in 2026. You know, are PTCs still going to be around? Are they not? What's the interconnection queue going to look like then? You know, today it doesn't look real great, but maybe by then we get all this figured out and it's cheap again. We just don't know. So there's a lot of uncertainty in specifying a replacement resource. So what is going to be cheap wind in 2026? I don't know.
So then you arrived on this price, which you feel is reasonable and lower than what we're paying currently through this PPA. Okay. All right. Thank you. No more questions.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, did you have any redirect?
No redirect and no further witnesses.
All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. Shook?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Shook. All right. We will move to public testimony portion of our hearing. Again, the commission is accepting written testimony until June 1st, 2020. Regarding this application and telephonic testimony today. We're checking right now if anybody has called in wishing to testify by telephone. But again, if you do wish to provide testimony by telephone, I'd ask that you contact us at 701-328-4081. While we're checking on that, I will note that if you send in any written testimony, the commission would ask that your written testimony have your name, an address, and a post office address if that differs. And if you're representing an entity or a group, please identify the group and your relationship to that group or entity with your comments. Do we have anybody? All right. I have been notified that we have not had anybody calling in to provide public testimony today. So we will move to closing remarks. Mr. Simpson, did you have any closing remarks today?
Nothing of substance. I think we had a very good and fulsome discussion today about a lot of things that are going on in the utility industry. And I just think that regardless of differences of opinion with respect to the future of the utility industry, it's clear on the record here that the Maurer County project is prudent because it's in customers' best interest, given the facts surrounding that project itself, no matter how you want to look at it.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, did you have any closing remarks?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu, did you have any closing remarks? All right, thank you. Commissioner Crotchis, did you want to make any closing remarks?
I just want to say thank you, everyone, for the hearing, for your time today, and for answering the questions that we put forth and clarifying some of the various questions that I know I certainly had and others as well. So thank you for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you. Commissioner Chrisman, did you have any closing remarks?
I do not, Your Honor, except for to thank everyone and then wish everyone a safe but enjoyable Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk, did you have any closing remarks?
Sure. I appreciated the discussion today and especially the digging in a little bit more on the integrated resource plan, since we don't have a overall review and approval process for those plans. It's helpful to have a good discussion on those things as issues come up that are related to them. So I appreciate that and think that we had have a good solid record on which to base the decision on this case, and appreciate everybody's time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Did the parties discuss a deadline for Northern States Power to respond to any written public testimony that might be filed? Mr. Simpson, I'll ask you.
No, Your Honor. Reserving the right to do so, we would probably want 2 weeks from the close of the record to provide any responses. And if there are no submissions by that June 1st record close date, we'd propose 2 weeks to get proposed findings filed.
Okay, so I'm looking at my calendar. So if there's written public comments, June 15th, to respond to those comments, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you want that as a deadline for proposed findings as well, or did you want additional time?
If we receive comments, I would propose that we just work it out with staff, depending on the nature of the comments. If we don't receive any comments, then why don't we just use the June 5th date to get proposed findings done?
All right. Is that acceptable to you, Mr. Johnson?
It is, Your Honor.
All right. And Mr. Hsu, is that acceptable to you?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And Mr. Simpson, did you anticipate any other late filed exhibits?
We don't anticipate any late filed exhibits based on today's hearing, nor do we anticipate briefing the issues.
All right. All right. Anything further, Mr. Simpson?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Johnson, did you have anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu, anything further?
Nothing, Your Honor.
All right, then I will note for our record that it is 11:32 a.m. on May 22nd, 2020, and the hearing for case number PU-19-310 on the application of Northern States Power Company for an advanced determination of prudence is now closed. Thank you all for participating today.
You.